You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything. Feel it coming. Till you wake up on your own. I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't cry.
In case you don't know, you slid into Cyber Monday there. Yeah, welcome to the future, Cyber Monday. Somebody who lives in the future, Alex Hollings, hasn't joined us in the present in about 3 weeks. Due to kind of a mutual scheduling issue. So, Alex, what's going on, man? Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, man. I'm happy that it's all almost over. I almost have an empty house again. It's getting so close.
Oh, really? You had a lot of people there?
Well, for me, you know, I'm relentlessly agoraphobic even in my own house, right? So, it was my daughter's birthday right before Thanksgiving on Saturday, so we had the whole family over for that, including my wife's parents that flew down. And then we had the Thanksgiving festivities, which were thankfully at my brother's house a little while down the road. And we've had some family friends stand with us throughout, which has been great. It's been great to see people, but I really can't wait to stop wearing pants, you know, around the house. I'm pretty excited about putting my pants back up and jumping back into a pair of basketball shorts and pretending like that's professional attire.
So, Thanksgiving was Thursday, man. Like, why is everybody still there?
I mean, I have to assume it's just because my wife wants to see how far she can push me before I jump off the roof.
Really? This is a test?
Well, you know, since we moved down here to Georgia, I do have a lot of family in the area, but my wife doesn't, you know? And family or, you know, friends from back home. So when we have this opportunity, when she manages to talk me into opening our house up to guests, I think that she just wants to, like, get as much of it in as she can before she knows that I'm going to freak out and not let anyone come over for a year. You know?
So how have you done? Have you done okay with it?
I would argue that I probably maintained a pretty presentable facade on the outside.
Well, that's good. That's a step. Yeah. That's a good. Right. That's a good step for you, right?
That is absolutely. You know,
well, congratulations! I think growing up before our own ears.
I think everyone is pretty aware of the fact that I don't like being around people at this point, but I think that I've managed to do it politely.
Oh, really?
Like at my daughter's birthday, you know, it's a birthday party full of adults, right? A 2-year-old's birthday party.
Those are kind of stupid.
Yeah, you know, and so it really, the day was supposed to be all about my kiddo, but you know how grown-ups are. Everybody bunches up and starts talking about grown-up stuff, and then my kiddo ended up kind of just hanging out playing with her new toys by herself. So I was more than happy to leave the grown-up party and just kind of like sit in her playroom and play with the fake power tools that I bought her as a... Because, like all girl dads, I just keep buying her boy toys. And, like...
There you go.
But hey,
those are like
desk back at the home. See, work is a controllable environment for me. I feel right at home.
Yeah,
I have 3 computer monitors, an iPad, a phone in front of me, and I feel more at home being inundated by all this information about how horrible the world is.
You need
than
to
I do
like,
in a room full of family members
like,
that love me.
I have 3 monitors, right? I've got a TV screen and a laptop, so that's 5. You need to step your game up, man.
There is a TV in here. I hardly ever turn it on. You know, and whenever I do, it's almost always is like I use YouTube for background research a lot,
right.
Which I'm sure sounds a little shady because like there's a lot of crap on YouTube. But there are some great resources on YouTube if you're kind of particular about where you pick, you know. There are some, especially when it comes to military aviation and stuff like that, there are some awesome historical documentaries on YouTube that you can find. That like you'd be surprised, it'll spur ideas for you, even if you don't work in this line of work. But you never know. Hearing stories about how they came up with the U2, you know, before they had computers, they're using slide rules and doing arithmetic with pencil, you know, and they built the U2 in 9 months.
Those dudes, right? With
those dudes
with the horn rim glasses and the pocket protector, right? The slide rule belt buckle. I mean, those dudes that, like, are the weirdest
guys,
people
like,
in the world.
Kelly Johnson was Lockheed Martin's, like, go-to engineer for a long time. And when you think of, like, the aircraft that changed everything, Kelly Johnson's name's all over all of them. I mean, he made the U-2, the SR-71, the C-130. I mean, if you name it, Kelly Johnson drew it on a piece of paper, and then we hammered it out of sheet metal. But the U-2 especially, he built the U-2 in, like, 9 months out in Area 51 before there was an Area 51. That's why there is one now. they went out there, just found, like, a stretch of dirt, you know, out in the middle of Nevada, and built an entire secret hangar, built a secret aircraft inside it, and managed to maintain, you know, the advantage over the Russians and the Chinese using nothing more than ingenuity and that slide rule, man. You know,
it's hard to watch
something like that and not get kind of motivated, you know?
Impossible, I would submit to you that if you watch that stuff, you can't help but be motivated. I mean, there's no way. I mean, I don't think. I mean, if you watch that stuff, And it doesn't inspire you. So, like, we have all these computers that do that shit right now, right? We had human beings that used to do it.
You know, and my favorite part of that story is that years later, they took the computers that they use. You know, I come from the era where they were teaching CAD, right? So that probably doesn't exist anymore. But, like, back when I was a kid, that's how they taught you to design things in a computer, right? Computer automated drafting. Is that what CAD stands for?
I don't know. It was way after my time. I just knew they were drawing shit.
But so when they, years later, when they had made the kind of the full transition over into using computers specifically to do like aerodynamic testing and stuff ahead of time, they fed the U2 into the computer, and the computer did not have any recommendations for changes that you could make to the platform to make it more aerodynamically sound. Yeah. That's how good these guys were by hand.
Can't do it. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, the computer looks at it and like, sorry, man, can't help you with this one.
Can you imagine?
You're on your own.
Because we're not talking about just making an airplane, which is crazy enough. You know, I did an article about the Cessna 172 for Popular Mechanics while back.
Your favorite.
Right, and I thought that the article was going to bore the shit out of me. Usually Popular Mechanics asks me to write about really cool aircraft, like the F-14, you know. And so when they assigned me the Cessna 172, you know, I reached out to a fighter pilot buddy of mine who he flies the F-35. And I was like, can you give me some quotes on the Cessna 172 to make it sound good? And he was like, I mean, it's a lawnmower you can fly. What do you want me to say? You know, but when you dig back into the history of the Cessna, Cessna the company, not the 172 specifically, but it really was just a dude in a barn, just like hammering on metal. That's incredible to me, absolutely incredible. But then when you think about Kelly Johnson making the U2 in 9 months, honestly, only a few decades after the Wright brothers were first coming up with what an airplane even could be, and he built a plane that would fly on the edge of space, you know, using a slide rule. They were hammering metal. The factories that they did use, they would only use on the weekends so that no one would see what they were making. That's how secretive it was. And they managed to make this airplane that'll fly so close to space that the pilots have to wear spacesuits. You know, and you fast forward and we can't build a rocket. You know, it's a real bummer about modern American ingenuity, but the history is definitely inspiring. You know?
There you go. What I'm not sure how we went. Oh, we wound up there when we were talking about monitors and YouTube. Talk to me about how you generally do research for stuff. Do you start with the most general, like YouTube, and then you go to the specific? How do you?
You know what? It all depends on the topic. My favorite stories to write about are the ones that, unrelated to work, I find myself getting excited about running across. Like, I think in this day and age, we can all kind of relate to when you spot a story in your Facebook news feed, scrolling through Reddit, running through YouTube, whatever. You come across something where you're like, holy shit, man. Like, I've never heard of this. This is crazy. This is really interesting. And it doesn't even necessarily need to be true to get my interest. Because sometimes the most interesting part is figuring out how this is bullshit, right? But those are my favorite stories. There's lots of different ways I come across a story, and lots of different ways I may end up researching it. If it's a primary source story, like I know a guy who knows a guy who's in Syria right now, obviously my research for that starts with the guy, right? Starts with that right. primary source.
Right.
He tells me whatever it is that he has to tell me, and then it's my job to develop a reasonable context, right? But then other times, like I get assigned a story from an editor about the Cessna 172, and it's up to me to not only start digging into, you know, the background of the aircraft, but it's up to me to kind of find an angle that makes it worthwhile to the reader, right? So then my research comes with an inherent bias, and that bias is towards something interesting,
right?
When I'm working on that.
Well, I mean, come on. I mean, it's not a nonprofit organization, correct?
Right, absolutely. And
so
I think that
you've got to have a hook.
When it comes to writing articles like that, like a technology analysis piece where I'm going to write about the history of the U-2 spy plane, I kind of do approach it a little bit like an op-ed. And I don't mean that I'm going to inject my opinion in it, but what I mean is the article is called Why the U-2 is Such a Badass Plane. You're going to expect me to talk about why the U-2 is such a badass plane.
Hello.
In that article. I'm definitely going to touch upon some of the shortcomings of the aircraft, but the focus is supposed to be, it's a love letter to this engineering feat, right? So I have a little bit of, I have more leeway, I guess, with an article like that than I do with an article about the impeachment inquiry, for instance, because you need to be as objective and as straightforward as possible because you're going to be attacked for not being objective no matter what, right? But when it comes to an article like why the U-2 is such a badass plane, why the F-14 is such a kick-ass plane, I really get to kind of approach it like a 10-year-old, you know, which is the coolest thing in the world. I get to, you know, talk to pilots like a fanboy instead of trying to dig up dirt. You know, I don't like dirt digging. That's not the type of journalism I'm into. I really like writing about, like, how incredible these crazy things that we've accomplished are. That's why I write so much about the Gemini and Apollo programs, too, is just because, don't get me wrong, NASA to this day is doing incredible things. Our astronaut corps to this day are doing incredible things. But back in the Gemini and Apollo era, those dudes were, you know, real American heroes. They were...
Let me tell you, if you haven't been to the Air and Space Museum out by...
And North, I haven't.
Oh, you're a total piece of shit, then.
I agree.
Oh, my God. You would wet your pants. Mommy, what's wrong with...
I am so guilty.
What's wrong with Daddy?
Oh, when I travel. I really need to start doing fun stuff.
He's got to go change his pants. Again, Mommy? Yeah, he's struggling today. The dude, you would lose your fucking mind. The Enola Gay is out there.
So cool, man.
I know. All of a sudden, you're walking down this... You're walking down this goddamn... excuse me for saying that. Walking down this fucking this walkway, and you look off to the right because you walk across this walkway, and you're looking down onto the floor, and the planes are like staring you in the eye, right? So it's that walkway that's elevated, and you're walking across it, and then there's stairwells that lead you down to the floor, but you're walking, and all of a sudden you're walking, and I'm looking. And it says Enola Gay. And I'm like, oh, this must be a replica. Oh, no. It's the fucking real one.
I mean, it's honestly, it's like...
No, it's mind-blowing. You come around corner after corner, and there's other shit like that. And you're just like, are you kidding me, man? And you haven't been, you haven't been there?
The Enola Gay.
What is wrong with you?
The aircraft that dropped the atomic bomb on Japan, right?
Everyone knows.
Was it a B-29 or I think it was a B-29. Whatever, it was a B. This is literally like getting to see the pistol that killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand, right? It's like it has changed the entire course.
Yeah, and even better, there's the site, the Norden site that was in the plane that day is sitting right there. This is the site that
like,
they checked
think
out.
Think about that. The nuclear era started in that aircraft. Prior to that aircraft dropping the bomb, all atomic weapons were these things that we had tested. And we had not even really tested that thoroughly or that successfully. The entire world, that is absolutely a BC to AD transition for us. the first atomic weapon used in combat. The world would never be the same again. Just imagine being near that. You don't have to imagine. You were there. That's a mind blower to me. That's incredible.
Yep. Yep. But, no, dude, it's not even that far from you.
That's awesome, man. That's incredible.
You should slap yourself across the face, loser.
Like, okay, the last time I was in D.C.
And you've been up there. How many times have you said, oh, I'm driving to Pennsylvania. Oh, I'm driving to Maine. I'm driving to New Brunswick.
A million times. You know, yeah. It's just like when I was stationed in 29 Palms driving cross country all the time. I never saw the Grand Canyon. The hell's the matter with me? You know, I've seen more huge tourist traps and monuments and natural wonders outside the U.S. than I have inside the U.S. And that's a real.
But that is not a tourist trap. Let me just tell you, I went with my son, who was stationed.
Anything that people are supposed to go to is a tourist trap, man. But some of them are better than others.
Some. Well, so they said, well, we're going out to the Air and Space Museum out by Dulles. Have you been? I said, no. And they said, it's supposed to be really good. And I was like, well, whatever. You know, I'll go. My grandson will be there. I'll have a good time. Right? My son, my daughter-in-law. So we go. I got there, and my son looks at me and goes, oh, no. and my daughter-in-law looks at him and goes, what? And he's like, my dad's going there. What do you mean? He'll be here for 9 hours. He won't leave.
Yeah, we're never going to see
him. Yeah, he won't leave. You don't understand what's happening right now. He just went into the history place. And he doesn't come out of there.
I threw a bachelor party for my best buddy in Denver a few months ago. And the real premise of the bachelor party was we were doing a 14,000-foot summit. But we still had another day and a half in the city. So the other guys in the party really assumed that I would be, like, taking us from strip club to strip club or something. And instead, the day after the climb, I brought us all to the Denver Science Museum because they have life-size replicas of a bunch of different, like, Mars rovers and spaceships and stuff. And so I literally did bring my buddy's bachelor party to the Science Museum and had us all sit in the, what do they call those? Like when you sit in the big dome and they show you like a space show.
It's called being a geek.
Yeah, it was awesome, like I think 7 or 8 third grade classes.
But it's awesome stuff, right? I mean, it's
awesome stuff, absolutely.
And if you could, let me just tell you this. If you've never, so then you walk back. And here's the space shuttle back there.
Oh,
holy shit, man. It's one of the space shuttles is back there. That thing is fucking ginormous. And then, and you, now, this is where you're, you know, daddy had to go change his pants again, honey. There's the Gemini, there's the Apollo, there's all those things, and you're standing there, and it's like, this one was one Gus Grissom rode the blah, 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 and you're just...
Gemini capsules, man.
There's real stories
of Neil Armstrong doing math by hand, longhand, using a chalk pen on the window of the capsule to figure out where the hell he's
going.
And you're looking at it,
and you're saying, you know, yeah, they're calculating time, distance, and speed, and force, and all the rest of the stuff they could do. But you're looking at some dude, right, in that thing, strapped to the top of a rocket.
Here's the Gemini missions. The Gemini missions weren't even able to get life insurance through the government.
Not even through the government?
No.
So what do you mean? What does that mean?
They literally signed 8x10s to give to their wives because if they died, they would have been the first American to die, you know, in space. So it would have been a real big deal. So they signed a bunch of 8x10s for their wives to sell.
To sell?
In the event that they died during
the
flight.
So wait a minute. The government didn't say, look, we can't insure you because nobody will do it. But just this says that if you die, we'll give your wife like $500,000. Nothing like that.
Not to my knowledge. Maybe
it was like, hey, sorry.
But as far as I know, the early Gemini missions, the guys literally, I mean, they were literally going up with nothing to do. There were no controls inside the capsule early on. It literally was a test to see if you'd come back alive, you know? And when you think about that, because we were in the early days of spaceflight, now we tend to think of spaceflight as relatively boring, and for good reason, because we've worked really hard.
Well, I don't know. You know what? Like, we've had some colossal failures, and so I think we got into a phase.
But NASA does a really bad job of marketing their endeavors. You know what I mean? It seems whenever you watch a NASA press conference, I'm always like, guys, what are you doing? You're going to spend 4 hours talking to us about the numbers on the spreadsheet? That is not what's going to get kids excited about NASA. And you need kids to be excited about NASA so that when they're older, they will vote to fund NASA. You know, NASA's funding keeps getting smaller, while their goals keep getting loftier. I actually wrote an article not long ago about why NASA keeps failing, why we don't have an SLS, why it is that we can't get back to the moon. And the real reason is honestly, it's the president. And I don't mean it's our current president. I mean it's every president. Every president comes in, completely moves the goalposts, changes what it is that NASA's supposed to accomplish, and then cuts the budget again. So every 4 years or 8 years, they start over. And this is the reason why we can't get anything accomplished. But back in the Gemini days, it was different. You know, it was very much a national security enterprise. You know, the space race was a military endeavor.
Right.
NASA was getting 4% of the national budget as opposed to 0.4% that it gets today.
How about
that's
that?
Huge, you know?
Right, the DOD, right, gets what, 6?
Yeah, I know it gets quite a bit less than Social Security, and I think Social Security is at like 12, right?
Yeah, think about that. Think about the space program got 4.
The space program was almost as well funded as our military apparatus.
That's crazy.
Our military apparatus isn't necessarily well funded; it's just huge.
Yeah, think about that. I mean, that's a huge number.
And this is the reason why we can't get back is because it costs the same now as it did then when we built the Saturn V. We didn't build it to be here for a long time. We built it to be here for a good time. It's like a very different endeavor. The Saturn V, only 13 of them ever launched, ever. And when we did launch them, every time, we were like, there's a pretty good chance it's going to explode. You know? So when you build something like that, the first Saturn V launch was the first time we tested half the shit the rocket was made of. When you do it like that, you don't build the infrastructure to keep going back. So we literally have to reinvent the wheel in order to get there. And that's why we can't get there right now.
What's your favorite thing to write about?
My favorite thing to write about is the weird shit that I should not be allowed to write about.
This is your life, Alex Holling. So what is it?
I have an article that just hit the Drudge Report over the weekend, so it's doing real world traffic right now. About there's a new movie coming out that's supposed to be based on a true story about the exorcism of a soldier on Fort Bragg.
Oh, my God.
And so I started digging into it because I really do love researching weird things.
Yeah.
A lot of times editors are not real down for me to write about them, you know? So whenever I get an opportunity to kind of dig into something weird, I like to. And this story is interesting largely because there's some real facts.
Come on.
No, I'm not saying that exorcisms are even real, but I'll say this. So the premise of this article, or the premise of this movie, excuse me.
Have you seen the original movie?
The movie that's coming out is based on a secondhand relayed, quote, true story.
Right? All right.
But the movie is supposed to come out here in the next, I think, next year?
No. I mean the original movie.
The original exorcism on Fort Bragg?
No, the original exorcist.
Oh, the original exorcist, absolutely, of course. Actually, I think that some of the guys involved in the original exorcist might be involved in this movie.
Oh, my God.
But I think this movie is going to be a crock of shit. So I don't really believe in ghosts, but my wife very passionately does, right? I don't really know that I believe in anything, so it's hard to believe in ghosts. So my wife and I have done a lot of ghost hunting because I like to be outside, and she likes to chase ghosts. So it kind of worked out in our favor. So we've gone all over the Winchester Mystery House in California.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we've been to all the places.
No, only people from out of state go to that. It's like people like that come and they visit. Like, have you been to the Winchester?
To walk around a house that was built with bad plans. You know, I've never seen anything that sold me, you know, but I know a lot, for instance, about...
Hold on. I got a couple of emails for you.
What
air and space museum are you talking about? What's the name of it, Alex?
The Smithsonian, isn't it? The Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in D.C.?
There's one downtown, right? I think, and that's I thought
oh,
we were going to
literally
see,
just called the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum.
And it's out by well, there's one on the mall.
This one's on Independence Ave.
The Stephen
I,
F.
I don't know. I've never been. So I, you know.
Udvar Hazy Center near Washington Dulles Airport is a companion facility to the museum on the mall. So that's the one to go to. The Udvar Hazy Center. Okay, that's the one you want to go to. Okay, I mean you could go. I think
I was even in D.C. not all that long ago, but I was there literally just to go swing by the Pentagon.
Loser.
And like,
check on your boys.
Was so miserable that I was like, not only am I leaving the city, but I don't envision coming back.
Oh, you have to now. There's no choice. Right? There's no choice. I mean, let me just tell you. So we went, like I said, I was just tagging along. You know, I didn't know shit, right? I mean, when you see this, right, the SR-71, the Blackbird is out there.
Dude, my favorite airplane of all time.
Yeah, I mean, come on. You
Kelly
and like
Johnson,
I said,
again, Kelly Johnson designed that one too.
You walk in and you see all these different incredible pieces of aviation. But again, the SR-71, right, you see the space shuttle, you see all of our stuff, you see the Enola Gay, and it just keeps, every time you walk around the corner, you're like, you gotta be shitting me. Japanese Zeros, Messerschmitts, you know, it's like, it's just, it's amazing.
I
was blown away.
The coolest thing about getting to see them in the same place would be getting to kind of develop an appreciation for the scale. I'm always surprised at how big aircraft are.
Well, let me tell you, that's one of the things, when you see the space shuttle,
it's got to be massive, right?
Oh, my God.
I've never seen it in person.
No, you look at it and you're like, are you kidding me? Things absolutely, it's ginormous. It's more ginormous than ginormous would indicate. Here's another one called Wet Pants, or Pants Wedding. Has Alex done the U.S. Air Force Museum in Dayton, the real Memphis Belle, Colonel Robin Olds, F-4? It's an awesome place for an aviation geek. The Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola has some great dioramas. By the way, thanks for getting the bonus Jeff and Tim episode up on the podcast so promptly. I got to get through it uninterrupted on my drive Thursday morning. The only Eddie Gallagher worship. Oh, the online Eddie Gallagher worship is making me sick. Oh, we can talk about that. But have you been to any of those museums?
I haven't. I have a buddy who...
Dude, what is your deal, man? You're like this wannabe aviation dork and you don't go to any...
Or it's like I've got a fucking job, man.
But you find time to go to the guy to the Winchester House, man.
Just fly around the country and talk to people.
Oh, now we're going to go there? Of all the cards you could play, you want to play the personal info card with me?
I'm just saying, you know, you've got you know, all this travel. You're this big deal. People are flying you all over the country.
Here we go.
I've got deadlines. Right.
I just say, hey, just so everybody knows, I didn't start this. All right, loser. let me ask you this: what do you make of the whole Trump Gallagher? And now, what's interesting is there's interviews coming out that are kind of bubbling up. There's a big internal debate going on inside the SEAL community, which we already knew was going on, and this is kind of the outward manifestation of it, right? The Gallagher thing, and the internal debate was kind of, we take care of our own, you know, whatever happens, you know, inside of us, our team stays inside of our teams, and then you have the reform movement that has raised younger SEALs to say, look, we ain't about doing all that other bullshit that used to happen. And you have to stand up. If this stuff is going to change, you have to change it. And so the Gallagher case is the outward bubbling of junior SEALs going to leadership on three separate occasions saying that somebody's got to hold him accountable for what he did, right? And then the case happened. So it's not like this debate internally came after these events. The case is a result of the ongoing fight inside that community for its own soul. Who's going to govern the soul? So you
watched
all...
I would argue that the Gallagher situation is a symptom. Right. It's not an illness, right? The Gallagher situation is one symptom of a much broader illness, not just within the SEAL community, but within SOCOM at large.
Right.
And I know SEALs on both sides of this debate. I know a lot of special operators on both sides of this debate. I want to be clear that I'm not among them. I'm not a special operator. So
you don't kid yourself. You were a special administrative operator.
I was a special administrator. Yeah, Force Marine Cod admin is what I did.
How could we could give that an acronym? I was a so. Can you get an A in there?
Can we get an A somewhere in there? But you may have noticed if you do go to SOFREP a lot that I've kind of stayed out of this debate because a lot of the guys that I work with are SEALs and Green Berets and Delta guys and you know I want to give them plenty of room to voice their opinions without me being an armchair quarterback, right? However, in my opinion, first of all, the Gallagher worship is insane. We're not talking about. I understand that he was acquitted, but we're not talking about a guy that warfighters should emulate.
Well, can I make a point? Acquitted doesn't mean you're innocent.
Agreed. You know. Now, I'm not saying that Eddie Gallagher's never done anything heroic. I'm not saying he hasn't ever done anything that warrants our admiration and respect. But you need. I used to say this about being a Marine to my guys all the time. The day that you get your EGA, someone hands you an Eagle, Globe, and Anchor, is not the last time you earn it. You have to earn your Eagle, Globe, and Anchor every day.
Every day.
The minute that you become a piece of shit, as far as I'm concerned, you're not a Marine anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So when you hear stories about a guy who was in the Marine Corps in the 90s and now commits a horrible crime, the headline may be, Marine commits horrible crime. But as far as I'm concerned, you're not one of us. You're not in my gun club, right? That's the mentality that I maintain. Navy SEALs, we're talking about a much more elite organization, a much smaller organization that's much harder to get into, right? So they really do protect their own to a large extent, and for a while there, for good reason, right? Navy SEALs, clandestine operations by nature, are illegal in the nation in which they're carried out, right? So whether you're a SEAL, you're a Delta guy, you work for CIA paramilitary, whatever it may be, if you're doing classified operations, chances are very good that you are killing people illegally, you are stealing things illegally, and if you get caught in the nation that you're operating in, you're probably going to be subject to their laws, right? Which means your job is to commit crimes. That is very much what these people do as their means of employment. So because of that, you develop this natural inclination to protect one another because when you're operating in Afghanistan or Syria or the Soviet Union 30 years ago, if you get caught, it really is us against the world, right? The problem is that culture became such an intrinsic part of the community that it pervades even when you're back in garrison, right? So you're back stateside, and you still see yourself as operating outside the realm of these laws and protecting one another, right? Because that's what you always do, and that's what you have to do to survive. And we did not do a good job as a military organization in creating a clear delineation between how you operate in theater and how you operate in garrison. Now, I'm not blaming this entirely on the leadership, but there's obviously a lot of leadership failures at play here, right? So I know some SEALs who say that this is all the leadership's fault because you can't give guys this deployment off tempo and expect them not to get their bells rung psychologically. Okay, I can accept some of that.
Well, and the other part is what they expanded, right? And there's guys who said, you know, some of these guys would have never been able to, you know,
wouldn't have made the cut.
Would have not have made the cut previously. And so, and those are all valid. Those are all valid points.
Now, conversely, I also know I can think of one in particular, but a few Navy SEALs that I've spoken to in the last few weeks that say that as Navy SEALs, you should be held to the highest standard,
uh-oh,
not a different standard than most warfighters. Because you're a Navy SEAL and therefore can get a bigger Twitter following, you know, as I really don't think, I think it would be foolish of anyone to assume that Donald Trump jumped into this fray without the goal of kind of helping affirm his political base. Right.
Well, let me ask you this question. Do you believe Donald Trump gives a shit about Ed Gallagher?
Not at all, honestly. I think that as the commander-in-chief, he's got every right to get involved. But yeah. No, I don't think that his intentions were good. I think that his intentions were self-serving. And I think that honestly, it hurts the U.S. military internally, and it hurts perceptions of the U.S. military externally. All Donald Trump had to do was let the system do its job. Now, the system might not have done its job well, but at least that way it wasn't the president's fault. But instead, he decided not to let the system do its job. And that really does... So I know an Army PAO guy who got thrown out of the Army for sending an email that to his officer, to his OIC. He was part of the 160th SOAR, right? The Night Stalkers. His name is Ricardo Branch. You can look him up. I've written a few articles about him. Ricardo Branch was PAO for the 160th. After President Obama congratulated the 160th on their involvement in the Bin Laden raid in the press, his boss mentioned it to another journalist, and Branch emailed his boss, a captain, to say, we shouldn't say that because Obama did, it's still technically classified. He got thrown out of the Army for that. Technically, he was denied reenlistment. He wasn't thrown out. So you take something like that, that guy's out of the Army, right? And then you take Eddie Gallagher, gets to keep his trident because of an absolute mishandling of his case. And it really bothers me because it shows that there's a different standard. And the standard seems to be based on the political value that you have to the president's campaign.
Well, I would tell you this. The standard, from my experience, is the standard whoever is directly above you and the people above them, whatever standard they decide to apply to you.
Yeah, and it's certainly not uniform at this point.
Oh, God, right? No. And let me just tell you, I have friends that but for the grace of God, they'd have been out of the Marine Corps 30 years ago. And what happened? When they did something stupid, they had somebody standing there who was a grown-up who said, hey, come here, I need to talk to you about that. Okay.
And you know, and I'm not opposed to that.
Right.
But as far as I'm concerned, though, that's still within the military hierarchy.
Right.
I was always the leader that said I'd rather handle this at my level.
Right.
I didn't want to bother Mac. Right. I didn't want to go call the sir.
Well, again, right? When it's appropriate, you have to.
But if you can handle it at your level, handle it at your level.
The question is, what breaks squelch? And in a case like your friend, if somebody decides that somehow or other that he strayed out of his lane and says, while not charged, was implicated in the mishandling.
Which is important to note that Branch was not.
Right? Was implicated in the mishandling, therefore, recommendation for reenlistment denied. If you have somebody
that. We're talking about a 16-year E6.
Right.
So, lost his career over an email.
If you have somebody like that sitting over you, it's a caste system. And you can go outside it, but then what does the system tend to do? The system tends to, just like the SEALs have done, cover down on itself. And
you know, and I think that if you want evidence to show that I'm not just a never-Trumper, if you want evidence to show that Donald Trump is politically motivated in this realm, I would ask you how many secretaries of the VA have there been during the Trump administration? I could tell you it's 5. Okay. Who is currently the role at the VA that's supposed to be responsible for suicide prevention is currently gapped and filled by an interim person who used to be in charge of the call center, which we all know worked really well. Right? The VA left millions of dollars on the table last year that they were supposed to use for suicide prevention outreach in the media, and they didn't at all. And when they were asked, why did you not spend the millions of dollars we allocated for suicide prevention, they said, well, we've had a revolving door at the VA and other leadership positions, so we haven't had any clear guidance on what we're supposed to do. So the VA, the veteran side of the element, has not been well taken care of throughout the Trump administration. Then you look at the military side. There has been an increase of funding and readiness, which was a platform promise he made, and I'm grateful that Donald Trump fulfilled this promise. He really did help us to get the National Defense Authorization Act pushed through with increases in defense spending that we needed to stop crashing aircraft and driving boats into each other.
Well,
the problem is,
yeah,
is that here we are now on continued resolution spending again.
I have a broken promise
to our military. It is showing that, honestly, right now, Republicans and Democrats, this is not a Trump problem. This is our government problem. They're more interested in the Trump impeachment inquiry than they are in just doing their job. And America is more interested in the impeachment inquiry than they are in hearing that the government isn't doing their job. Everybody just wants to talk Trump. Nobody really wants to talk that we are failing to do basic, fundamental things that we need to do to keep our defense apparatus running.
General Mattis has a quote that I used to play, right? That there's no enemy of the United States that has done the damage right, to the
sequestration continued resolution spending.
Exactly. And it's the truth.
Now, if you're not familiar for anybody out there with what continued resolution spending is, we call it CR spending. What it is when the government fails to pass a budget by the time the new fiscal year starts, which is November 1st, right? The budget's supposed to be passed October 1st. The idea is that without a budget passed, you move into continued resolution spending, which is spending without a budget. And what that means is that you really pretty much strangle all of your programs, and all new initiatives are put on hold.
Now,
right?
Let me ask you this. What triggers sequestration?
So sequestration was, as far as I know...
When you can't agree on the continuing resolution?
It effectively was a spending limit put into place during the Obama era that was supposed to... So during the Obama era, we had this great idea to reduce America's combat operations, and it's the Office Space approach. It's the Milton from Office Space approach. So if you remember in Office Space, Milton was this guy that was supposed to be fired like 3 years ago, and they never told him. And through an accounting error, they kept paying him, so they decided to just solve the accounting error and not worry about the confrontation of firing him and let him just realize he's fired. We tried to do that with combat ops by using sequestration to limit our defense spending, to curb defense spending. We assumed that the rest would work itself out. Once we gave our defense apparatus less money, it would inherently start doing less stuff and everything would balance out. But our lawmakers didn't let them start doing less stuff. So instead, we just saw aircraft maintenance programs fall flat. We saw training programs fall flat. We saw new tech initiatives never start or fall flat. These things all happened because the F-22 program is a great example. These things all happened because we were like, well, if we just stop paying for it, the rest will work itself out, right? That did not work, obviously. So now we're dealing with the repercussions of that, and that's why our readiness is in the toilet, even though we have a huge defense budget, right? It's because we have not been maintaining any of our shit for years. Now, continued resolution spending is a little bit different. That is not intentional. That is entirely the result of our fuck-up. Whereas sequestration is intentional, and in my opinion, a bad idea, CR spending is literally the result of our failure as a nation to pass a budget. And it's infuriating. I'm so angry that people aren't upset about this. You know, especially after Donald Trump campaigned on bringing the readiness levels of the U.S. military back up. Now we've got four ships have already had their maintenance programs delayed by CR spending. Now we have all these new initiatives that are curbed, stopped, halted, and it's going to take months after they finally pass a budget to get things moving again, because these government contractors, they have to pay their bills.
Well, so and what happens is that, frozen, yeah, they go, and that was, you know, one of the things about the F-18 was that when sequestration happened, they could not tell these guys, yeah, you're going to be employed here for longer than the next 90 days. And so people went and found other jobs. In that
especially
industry.
When we say we're not, you know, that contract we promised you, well, it's not starting anymore, and we don't know when it'll start, but it's going to start eventually. When you're that business or that employee, you go, well, I need to find other work in the meantime. So you pick up another contract, and then Uncle Sam comes back around and says, hey, Congress finally got around to passing a budget.
Let's
we
do
want
this.
To start that program.
Yeah.
But now you're under contract with another company to fulfill their contract. So you go, okay, well, we can start it, but it'll be April, because that's when we're done with this one.
Yeah, or we'll have to hire other people, and that's going to take us probably at least 4 or 5 months to get the requisite number of people,
and
to get everything in place.
And significantly more money than it would have before when we had the people on staff
and you can, so you can see, and so what happened with the F-18 program is you had parts that didn't exist that didn't get made. You had you know, craftsmen that had very unique skills that refurbished, you know, F-18s, the whole line, and they went and found other jobs. And then all of a sudden you had, what, almost, you know, two-thirds of the American aviation fleet, and the number in the Department of the Navy was ridiculous. And everybody's like, well, why can't this happen? That's why sequestration is such a horrible thing.
Because just imagine if you're the employee, you were an F-18 guy, and now you went and got a job at GE or at Boeing or something else.
Yeah.
It's a great paycheck, good benefits, you know, you've got a 401k, And then Uncle Sam comes back knocking. You know, you get a call from General Dynamics. Yeah. We want to pay you about what you're making now, maybe a little bit less, and the job is for 6 months. Why on earth would you take it?
Hold on.
You're not going to take it. You're going to keep your good job.
Let me not talk to my wife and give you the answers she'll give me. No.
No, right? Exactly. You know, and this is the reason why, you know, the talent pool shrink. This is, we have this problem a lot with shipbuilding. Our country's shipbuilding infrastructure isn't really big enough to support our naval endeavors for these new ships and subs that we want to build. But part of the reason why our infrastructure isn't big enough is because there's no consistency in funding. You know, these shipbuilding companies do not want to maintain a huge, you know, they have layoffs literally every year.
Right.
You know, and the more people you hire, the more people you have to lay off. So they aren't going to keep a staff on site that's enough to build a Ford class supercarrier. They're going to hire them for the job and then lay them off when it's done. So when you delay these things, you make everything cost more. You have to re-recruit, or you have to keep these people on the payroll, which will cost more. And then what ends up happening when you change? Imagine if you had a contractor building your house, and then you changed a third of the way through, and then you changed a third of the way through again. Three completely different companies building the same house. There's going to be some shit wrong with your house.
Yeah, that would work out well, wouldn't it?
You know,
no,
but we for some reason think we can do it with the most complicated, largest warship ever devised. You know, yeah. Like,
no, it's stupid. It's stupid. And but you know what? The country really isn't interested in it. In fact, I was just, as you and I were talking, I was thinking, you know, most people are listening going, this is so boring, funding sources and yeah, sequestration and all that, right? But let me tell you, it is the bedrock, right, of the DOD.
It really, you know, I always bedrock. Say this about conspiracies too. The reason why conspiracies really do work, the ones that are out there and really malicious, they work because they're boring, you know?
No.
If we found a conspiracy about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton getting together to, like, make out with reptilians, that's exciting and sexy.
And you know, right? It's happened. Come on. Don't kid
right?
yourself.
But then when you hear a conspiracy theory about, like, Viacom injecting funds into the FCC so that they can develop more of a monopoly in this specific region around Seattle, nobody gives a shit because it's boring.
Right.
And these boring conspiracies really do run a lot more of our country than a lot of people realize. They're not all nefarious. A conspiracy is just a group of guys with the same goal, right? Not every conspiracy is nefarious, but there's a lot more of them than people think. They're just boring, you know?
Yeah. What about all right, let's talk about in the next 6 minutes, let's talk about what are you writing these days?
I got a couple of pretty cool stories coming out this week, I think. One of them I'm just working on right now. Again, it's about what's going on in Yemen. The Houthi rebels, who have been, I think, for about 5 years now, engaged in some pretty intense conflict with the UAE.
Okay, hey, hold on. First of all, you're cutting.
A week and they shot down an Apache.
Wait, you're cutting in and out for some reason, which normally doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's weird. I don't know what's on
my
internet.
I don't know. Do you have the Commandant of the Marine Corps gave a speech at the Ground Awards dinner, I want to say maybe 3 weeks ago, about his force design and what the Marine Corps is going to become. Have you done anything with that?
I haven't dug into it. I did see that he gave the talk, but I don't know all the nuts and bolts of it.
I can send you the link if you want to watch
yeah,
it.
Yeah, please do. I'd be happy to read
it. Well, no, because it's like, to me, there's some really interesting implications. So what kind of Buck Rogers thing is the Marine Corps going to become? And what happens to the rest of the war plans that the Marine Corps has got to supply forces that are supposed to come with tanks and tubed artillery and things like that, when all of a sudden we say, yeah, we're not into that anymore. We're ninjas. Uh-oh. The sub sound? Hello? Uh-oh. That is the bad Skype noise. That's a good Skype noise. fact that it continues, that's a bad Skype noise.
Can you hear me? Hello?
I can hear you now. What happened?
I have no idea. My internet didn't even go down. I'm not sure what happened. It just all of a sudden said that I didn't have you, and then I had a new call.
Uh-oh. CIA at it again.
You know, we're telling the truth.
Exactly. That's always dangerous. So my question is, and what I think is interesting is, you know, the Marine Corps is supposed to supply forces for all these different op plans and war plans. Okay, what happens when the Marine Corps morphs into something that doesn't have tanks and tubed artillery, and then there's a poor network connection? Hello? It might not be Alex, it might be me, but all my shit says I'm good. All his shit says he's good. See, and every time I go to ask, every time I go to ask the same question, all of a sudden it. Uh-oh. That means he's not on. Yeah, when you hear the let's go sub hunting sound, yeah, the sonar sound, means we're looking for him. Oh, here we go!
I do not know what's going on. My internet just keeps coming up and back.
Every time I go to ask you the same question, it goes out. Right?
This is faith intervention. I probably don't know the answer. I should just be happy.
No, well, no, but the question is, the Marine Corps is on the hook for all these forces and all these different op plans and war plans, right? So the Marine Corps decides to change itself as we pivot to the Pacific. What happens when we have to go someplace where we didn't think we were going to go?
Well, I mean, this is the classic, you know.
Because the DOD is not big enough anymore to say, yeah, it's okay, Marine Corps, you just do your own thing, we'll cover everything else. It's not that big anymore.
Well, so the problem is that the United States has a really bad habit of staying prepared for the war they used to fight and never preparing for the war they're going to fight, right? And because of that, though, the Marine Corps has always had to evolve pretty quickly, right? You know, in its earliest iterations, the Marine Corps was really sailors with guns, right? We were, in a large way, we were security on ocean-going vessels, right? The Marine Corps had to adapt to meet challenges in World War II, had to adapt to meet challenges and Korea, had to adapt to meet challenges in Vietnam and every other conflict, right? To the point where my generation of Marines are desert guys, you know? I mean, most of the camis I still have in this trunk back here, just in case Red Dawn ever happens, are desert camis, right? My generation of Marines, most of us didn't spend a lot of time on ship, right? Which was, at its earliest levels, what the Marine Corps was really built for. The Marine Corps has always been able to adapt and to evolve to the shape of the conflict that we have. And I think the Marine Corps has always been better at it than the Army because we're smaller, right? And we have a different mentality. In the Marine Corps, we know we're not going to get the best equipment. That's for the Army. We know we're not going to get all the money for the best living situation. That's for the Air Force. And we also know we're not going to get the best transportation or medical training. That's why we have the Navy, right? Because of that, though, we've gotten really good at adapting on the fly, right? Marines make mission is something I still say all the time in my day-to-day life because I think that it's an important mentality to have. Like, how many of us, you know, in the civilian world work with people who use "I don't know how to do that" as an excuse to not do it, right? The Marine Corps has never enjoyed that type of excuse. The Marine Corps at large and Marines in general have always had to make do with what they had on hand. I'm confident that the Marine Corps will always be able to shift its footing when it needs to defend this nation. How is that going to look? I don't know. But I do think that it makes a lot of sense to try to find a specific niche for the Marine Corps so that we're not competing as overtly with branches like the Army for funding. I hope I didn't lose you in that.
No. So my question is, so if his, and he talks about force design, he uses that term all the time, You know, what the Commandant does is force the sign. Well, there's some wickeds to that. The Commandant can propose that. But unless, you know, the...
Absolutely, right? Yeah, he doesn't have the final say, right?
But yeah, unless the House and Senate Armed Service Committees buy what he's putting down in terms of, we're taking the Marine Corps and we're going to turn right. Oh, maybe not. And so how much of a boutique can the Marine Corps become given its other general requirements that it has to service around the world?
So I think that's a really reasonable and fair question to make.
Yeah,
you know, I think that, and without knowing exactly what changes we're talking about, I think that the idea of needing to kind of establish a niche or that boutique skill set, I think the idea behind that is that we're always worried about the Marine Corps losing its funding, right? The Marine Corps is in constant competition with the Army over the operations that it's going to participate in. Because just like SOCOM, just like in the special operations community, the global war on terror has really blurred the lines between what we count on different units and different branches to do, right? So we used to use Navy SEALs for amphibious warfare and Delta guys for anti-terrorist warfare, and Rangers are really just kind of like infantry support with machine guns that can help the other SOCOM units, not disrespecting Rangers that are really hard-working dudes. But, you know, all these different special operations units had very specific skill sets that were meant for very specific mission parameters. Global War on Terror threw all that shit away. And we were like, the commanders in theater are going to use the assets they have on hand. If that's Delta, if that's SEALs, if that's GBs, whatever it may be, we're going to use them because they're the best. They have the highest success rate of any of the units we have available to us. The Army and the Marine Corps have faced a very similar thing. The Marine Corps is never meant to be an occupational force. The Marine Corps does a lot of occupying at this point. The Army is not necessarily supposed to be an expeditionary force, but they do quite a bit of expeditionary force work, right?
Right.
It would be valuable for us as a branch, I say us as in the Marine Corps, it would be valuable for us to offer something that nobody else can do as well as we can do. So that way when we go and sit at that table, because as we establish a Space Force, which I'm on record for saying we need orbital defense, it might not be the most cost-effective way to do it, but it's a good idea. The pie isn't getting bigger. We're adding more pieces to it. So now there's a sixth branch in competition for funding. Fifth, technically, right? In competition for DoD funding. Because of that, the other branches, the Marine Corps included, have to have that much stronger an argument to not have any money taken from them. Because the money for that new slice has got to come from somewhere, right? This is why the Air Force was trying so hard to keep
space. Well, here's the thing, right? What he says is we may have to get smaller, which is, you know...
And there's a very likely chance, right? That everybody's going to have to get smaller to allow for another branch.
Well, but here's the deal, though. The money that you give up in personnel, you don't get to move that across the checkbook. It's not how that works, right? All of a sudden, we're going to take that money that we saved in personnel, and we're going to now slam it into our R&D or our procurement budget. It's not how those pots work.
Lines of accounting, right?
So right? Unless Congress says, unless Congress buys off on all of it, right, and says, okay,
absolutely,
we'll sit down with
that's
you.
That's exactly what, there's an approval process, right? Like even at unit level discretionary spending, I've got a buddy who does it for 4th Marine Division, where his job is literally to, you know, okay, you want this guy to come on ADOS orders, you want mm-hmm. that guy to go to this training.
Right.
His job is to determine how much money to put in each of these pools throughout the division,
right?
And we would run into this debate all the time if we had a reservist we wanted to bring on orders, usually like a lieutenant colonel, that'd be pretty expensive. You know, we'd go, well, shit, we still have $150,000 in this pool of money. Why can't we use that? And it's like, well, that money was allocated for picnic tables, so we can't touch it. You know, that is very real, but it's all literally lines on a spreadsheet. You know, it can very easily be moved at the high enough echelons, at the decision-making echelons, right? So, yeah, you could feasibly save money on personnel. The problem that you run into, the risk that you run, just like a lot of people can relate to in their regular jobs, is that when you cut, let's say, for instance, the amount of money the Marine Corps is investing into personnel, you run the risk of being told that that's just what you have now, instead of being told that you can use that funding elsewhere. You know, we've all had it happen where we thought we were doing the right thing. We came in under budget. And then the next year they say, great, you guys came in under budget. So that's your budget this year. Right. The Marine Corps, every branch is worried about this all the time. every branch is worried about what share of defense spending they get allocated to them. That's why the Air Force wants space defense so much. It's also why the Air Force has done such a shit job of space defense, is because they've been using money earmarked for orbital endeavors to fund ongoing combat operations elsewhere in country, because that's the easiest thing to defer funding to, obviously.
Right.
So the Air Force is now looking at the very real possibility of coming up shy of being able to fund ongoing combat operations. The Marine Corps does not want to put itself in that position. So the idea that, yeah, maybe we might need to get a little smaller, maybe we might need to get a little bit sleeker, I do see that as good forethought, because the decision might well get made for us, right? So we should have a plan ahead of time for us to be able to operate smaller and leaner and still meet the requirements, like you said, or like I was saying about sequestration. They're not going to start going easy on the Marine Corps just because they cut the budget. So the Marine Corps has got to find a way to fulfill the requirements that the United States government puts on it. And it's going to be tough.
Right. So, no, my, you know, so when you talk about force design, there are some intermediate steps, is that the House and the Senate have to buy off on your plan. They've got to agree, right, in essentially earmarking funds and moving them around and all that, all the shit that they do in order to make this happen. And part of that process is going to be checking the blocks and says, you say that you could still go to Africa and fight a ground war. You could still go to Europe and fight, you know, so anyway. So I think
it's important to remember that there's a million laws that we're probably not privy to that make this that much more complex,
right?
The same way that it's by legal mandate, even though we probably have like 25 aircraft carriers in the U.S. Navy, we only count 10 of them. Because if we were to count any any large vessel that can deploy aircraft as a carrier, then we could dramatically reduce naval spending to no longer support Nimitz and Ford-class carriers, and we'd end up with a dozen Wasp-class ships out in the Pacific. You know?
Well, let me tell you what you have now. I mean, by transitioning, you know, our large deck amphibs, in those squadrons, they're
I love this lightning carrier plan.
Right. With F-35s, the Bravos, that thing becomes, you know, a little badass, right?
You know, just imagine the force projection capabilities that you're offering. First and foremost, people need to know these large amphibs, they're the size of other countries' carriers. You know? Like, if you were to look at, like, the Liaoning or the Admiral, whatever the hell, Russia's broken carrier.
Kutsunov.
If you were to look at the HMS Queen Elizabeth, these amphib ships are not much smaller than their carriers, right? They are short decks, though, for to launch, let's say, like FA-18 Super Hornets. But they're great, as you said, for F-35 Bravos, for vertical landing, short takeoff F-35s. People don't realize the reason why the F-35 is short takeoff, not vertical takeoff, is literally because it could take off on low fuel and with no ordnance vertically, but that doesn't do you a lot of good, right? So they're designed for short takeoff so that they can carry, you know, a pretty heavy payload, they can carry a pretty good fuel range, and still take off from the deck of these amphibious assault ships. We have a lot of these amphibious assault ships. They're able to deploy the most capable and advanced fighter in existence. I really think that this is an opportunity for us to expand, especially when we talk about the Pacific, where amphibious assaults are going to be a real thing if we ever went to war with China. The ability to have smaller vessels that can launch F-35s will be a game changer for us. You know, I'm a big fan of that program. But that's what I mean about how the F-35 is really good at turning on their toes. You know, the Marine Corps, did I say the F-35?
Yeah.
The Marine Corps is very, very good at turning on its toes. The Marine Corps is very good at making quick adjustments to be whatever it is that the U.S. needs them to be. I would argue more so than any other branch. I'm always nervous during a time of change, but I do think that it's good that we're talking about change already.
Oh, no. I think it's absolutely essential, you know, with, again, modern lethality. But fate has a way, right, of finding the spot where, you know, you give away all your tanks and all of a sudden we're in a tank war someplace. It has a way.
The F-22, in my opinion, is a great example of this. Not only did we shut the program down halfway through it, we cannibalized its entire supply chain. So we could never build another. I wrote an article a long time ago about why we couldn't restart production of the F-22. Because it would cost just as much as the first time we built the F-22. And that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
We're very short-sighted You know, we're very good at preparing for the last war and not for the next one. And I hope that this is an example of doing the opposite. But I don't know, man.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, again, how... Because, again, the DOD is not big enough for the Marine Corps to say, yeah, we don't want to be that anymore. We're going to be this. And so unless the National Defense Strategy plan, right, and everything that goes into that, unless that gets tweaked to say, okay, the Marine Corps is doing naval expeditionary shit, and they're lightening up, and so Army, their role in this war plan, this war plan, this war plan is going to go to you. Right? I mean, unless then they have to look at the Marine Corps and say...
You're hitting a really important nail on the head here, that when we talk about contingency operations, contingency planning, we already have plans in place for countless potential conflicts in this world, right? And these plans, I mean, don't get me wrong, we pull them out every couple of years, dust them off, and update them, absolutely. But a lot of these plans, I was in the room during a planning operation for Iran years ago, right? That, as far as I knew, was one of those times where we pulled it out, dusted it off. We paid a bunch of lieutenant colonels and colonels to fly in and sit in a room and have me go get them coffee while they talked about it, right? But all of these plans are going to require fundamental changes if the way that a branch does its business changes. And that is something that when we're talking about that, we're not just talking about changing the plans. We're talking about changing the logistics. We're talking about changing the supply chain for these endeavors, because if the Marine Corps needs to conduct an operation that would normally be associated with the Army or vice versa, it's not just about getting the warfighters there. It's about getting support there. You know, there's three guys in support of every one guy kicking in doors. Those three guys have to get their asses in country as well. The boxes have to get there. The equipment's got to get there. It is a huge endeavor to change one of these plans. Right. And like you're saying, if we're going to change the way the Marine Corps does business, we're not just changing the way the Marine Corps does business. We're changing the way the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, they all have to adjust to
see. Right. No, well, I mean, normally referred to as second and third order effects of this.
Exactly,
And then the question is, okay, so Marine Corps, you're saving money, and then you want to spend it over here, but you're costing us this because now we have to stand up this capability here, which means you've got to do this, 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 and this. So you're actually the bill for the delta, right, for the change.
The bottom line
is this.
Is worse.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's to me what'll be interesting when he ultimately unveils. I think in his speech, I'll send you the link. He says, we're in the second half of the fourth quarter of this force design, all kept very secretive. And I guess
and I'd imagine that a lot of the planning for it is on hold because of CR spending. I'm just going to put that out there. Goddamn continuing resolution.
Exactly. All right. What are you writing next? When will we see it? Hello? There you have it.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Am I back?
You're back.
Have I lost you again?
No. Well, you did. Now you're back.
Well, now I'm back. All right. I'll be quick. Everybody.
Now you're gone. This is like jamming, okay? So just be patient, right? Here's what they used to teach us about jamming. You have to fight through it. You have to fight through it. And I never really experienced very much of it in my Marine Corps career until I went to the National Training Center and operated with the Army. And then I tell the story about changing frequencies 13, 16 times. Uh-oh, bad noise. I mean... Okay, so if you don't know Skype noises, the radar is searching, okay? When you hear the happy music, that means that person is on the network and you're calling them. It says Alex is unavailable. Well, we won't accept that. Thank you. Or maybe we'll bring Alex back tomorrow and find out what he's writing and where we can find it, and we will find that. We'll learn that tomorrow. Because it doesn't seem like he's coming back. It doesn't seem like he's coming back today. We'll see if he rings through before we get off. If not, we'll bring him back tomorrow, and we'll finish up our conversation with what he's writing now and when and where you can find it. Alex, always an interesting guy to have on, and a great part of the program. I'm hopeful that we can talk to Grant Newsham tomorrow. We'll see if that works out. So, thanks for listening. If you're just tuning in, I had a really cool experience over Thanksgiving, and people reach out to me, and the one in particular that triggered another one was a picture of somebody putting up the 3 goals and 10 commandments of post-traumatic winning in their house. And I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. Yeah. That somebody would read those things and then put them up on their wall in their bathroom so that they would see them on a regular basis. As a reminder of living better, right? Living the high life. So don't touch that dial. You'll hear that story. We'll check news. And then if you just caught the tail end of Alex Hollings, you'll hear from him as well. So on a Monday, yeah, the mother of all Mondays, the one after Thanksgiving. Is there a worse Monday than this Monday today? You've been fooding and familying and watching sports and now back to work. Cyber Monday of all things. So anyway, have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. On a Monday, All Marine Radio. Did you hear what just, that's Joe's head. As he's heard the music, he thinks the show's over. Yeah. Joe, you're going to get whacked. Anyway, have a great day. On a Monday, All Marine Radio, over and out.